The word Ezekiel means God strengthens, and it's a book of doom and of hope. Doom for the present because of their wickedness, hope of the future because of God's concern for them. And so we'll be looking at these principles as we move through the book. And many of the lessons he taught by action, by parables, by analogy, most any figure of speech that you're familiar with, Ezekiel used it somewhere. But before I look at the book itself, I think it's always good to look at the background of any book that you're about to study. What's the purpose of it? No book was ever written, so far as I know, in a vacuum. There's always a historical setting, a historical need for that particular book at that particular time. And so it is with the book of Ezekiel. Now, if I may, I want to go back for just a moment to before he gets there. In 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar was moving westward, and in 609, he destroyed the remnant of the Assyrian army. Now, the Assyrians had been the threat up until that time, but he destroyed the remnant of the army. But Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, went north to help the Assyrians against the Babylonians. Josiah, the king of Judah, and a good man, one of their better kings, he wanted to stop Necho because anybody to him would be better than the Assyrians. So he was killed in a battle with Pharaoh Necho, who was going up to meet the Assyrians in 609, to meet the Babylonians. And so Nebuchadnezzar then, after he had taken and destroyed that army in 609, in 603 he moved on south into Judah. To take Judah, and was taking Judah when he heard that his father, Nabopolassar, was dead. So then he made a quick, forced march back home, but he carried with him some hostages. And among those hostages, there was Daniel. He carried Daniel with him, along with other Daniel and his friends, into Babylon in this 605. All right? And he set up his own king, a puppet king, in Jerusalem. Later in 95-97, this king whom God set up, Jehoiakim, when he came back and subdued Jerusalem, didn't destroy it, but he subdued it. Now he carried away with him about 10,000 individuals, and among them was Ezekiel. He carried Ezekiel away at this particular time, that is to Babylon, in 597. Now, he was a young man, about 25 years of age. We'll learn in just a few moments, it seems that he was. But also, as he carried these people with him there, he set up Zedekiah. Zedekiah was a puppet king. He was related to the royal order, all right. But he was a very weak, vacillating individual, as we will discover when we read the book here. For Zedekiah is now the king of Judah, a puppet king of Nebuchadnezzar, who went back in 605 and took the throne, claimed it. I think one of a good understanding of the purpose of Ezekiel is indicated in the 24th chapter of the book of Jeremiah. If you want to turn to that chapter, I want to look at that for just a moment. 24th chapter here of Jeremiah. This will help you to understand what the purpose of Ezekiel was in Babylon. He carried away into Babylon with 10,000 captives at that time. If you want to turn to it, let me read this 24th chapter. Jehovah showed me, and behold, two baskets of figs set before the temple of Jehovah, after that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away captive Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and the princes of Judah, with the craftsmen and smiths from Jerusalem, and brought them to Babylon. One basket, now here's what he sees in this vision here. One basket had very good figs, like the figs that are first ripe. And the other basket had very bad figs, which no one could eat, which could not be eaten, they were so bad. In other words, they were rotting, and maybe flies had blown them and all of that, but anyway, they were unfit to eat. Then said Jehovah unto me, what seest thou, Jeremiah? And I said, figs. The good figs, very good. And the bad, very bad. They cannot be eaten. They are so bad. And the word of Jehovah came unto me, that is unto Jeremiah, saying, thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, like these good figs, so will I regard the captives of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for good. Now, Chaldea was the name of the province or the kingdom. Babylon was its capital. So if you call them Babylonians, all right. If you call them Chaldeans, you're all right. They were Chaldeans, just like we're Americans, but Washington is the capital. So you talk about a fellow Washingtonian or an American there. All right. And so now then, he said, in the land of the Chaldeans for good, the 10,000. Right? For I will set mine eyes upon them for good, and I will bring them again to this land, and I will build them and not pull them down, and I will plant them and not pluck them up, and I will give them a heart to know me, that I am Jehovah, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God, and they shall return unto me with their whole heart. Now, all right, now that's these folks. Now that's the one that Ezekiel is with. Ezekiel is with that group now that goes into Babylon at this particular time. And as the bad figs, which cannot be eaten, they are so bad, surely, thus saith Jehovah, so will I give up Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and his princes, and the residue of Jerusalem that remain in this land, and them that dwell in the land of Egypt. I will even give them up to be tossed to and fro among all the kingdoms of the earth, for evil to be a reproach and a proverb, a taunt and a curse in all places whither I shall drive them. And I will send the sword, the famine, and the pestilence among them till they be consumed from off the land that I have given them and to their fathers. Right? Now, why read that? Because Ezekiel is the one that God is going to use to keep alive faith in him in the land of Babylon. In the land of Chaldea, don't you see? So Ezekiel's real purpose and mission, when God calls him after a while to begin prophesying, was to preach to the people and to keep their faith in God and to assure them. Now, there were prophets, false prophets in Jerusalem that said, these people are going to come back. Well, within 2 years, they'll be back home again. So don't believe any of these folks that are saying they'll be there. Jeremiah said they would be there for 50 years. Now, they'd be under Babylonian captivity for 70 years. And these false prophets said, don't believe that. They're going to come home within just a couple of years. Right now, Ezekiel's purpose and work was to assure those people in Babylon they were not going to go back in 2 years. They would be there under the 50 years up of their captivity there. They'd be there for 50 years in captivity. And then they would go back. But now then, you don't believe this, how are you going to go back? So his mission was to try to keep alive faith in God. Now then, when Jerusalem fell, now Nebuchadnezzar came back and destroyed Jerusalem in 596. In 596, we have the fall of Jerusalem and the captivity here, the captivity of the people. Right? Now, I mentioned about 70 years and 50 years. Right? Now here, from this time here, 605 or 6, when they were carried away, and the 536, when they came back here to return now, later, return of the Jews, you do that from here down to here, you do that 70 years. But now then, from 536, you have 50 years. So they were actually, they were under Babylonian control for 70 years. They were actually in Babylon itself only 50 years. So you've got, and then it was 20 more years. They came back in 536. It was 516 before they rebuilt the temple. So we have without a temple from 76 to 16, you've got 70 years. They were 70 years without a temple. They were 70 years under Babylonian power. But they were in Babylon only 50 years. Now, am I clear on that, or am I confusing on that? Right, so they're under Babylonian power for 70 years. They were actually in captivity in Babylon 50 years. But they were without a temple for 70 years because they didn't rebuild the temple for 20 years after they came back. So you've got 2 70-year periods there to keep in mind and 1 50-year period in this matter, which sometimes is confusing to us, but because Jeremiah said they'd be there for 7 years, and they were. I mean, captivity 7 years, they were. So they were under Babylon for 20 years before they went. All right, so this now helps to understand this passage in Jeremiah, at least to help me to understand what Ezekiel's mission was. It was to preach God to the people, to try to hold them to the faith in God, to assure them they would not go back to Babylon or to Jerusalem, not until the time of Jeremiah was fulfilled. But Jeremiah is the one who said that they would be under the captivity for 70, said twice. Two different places, he made that statement. Right, so they would actually be ruled by Babylon for 70 years. The 20 years of that was before they went into captivity. Then when Babylon was destroyed in 536, or 39 rather, they were allowed to come back in 536. They didn't build a temple, they fooled around with it. And that's where Haggai and Zechariah come in. They would urge the people to rebuild that temple, rebuild the temple. They fooled around there for 20 years. And so they did finish the temple, and so that completed the 70 years without a temple. Right, now, if there's any question on it, I'd be glad to go over it again, because I think it's very important that we understand that, and I'll study of these prophets. Well, all right. So, as you look then at this, the emphasis on, in this, now another thing I want to talk about Ezekiel. Now, up until Ezekiel's time, those earlier prophets like Amos and Hosea and Micah and Isaiah, they put the emphasis on the nation. The emphasis on the nation as a nation. Now that the nation was going to be destroyed, Ezekiel put the emphasis on the individual. This is a point I'll bring out in chapters 18 and 33. Those two chapters especially, but all the way through you're dealing with it. But then we come to that particular time. All right, now there's an expression that's used over and over here. That is referring to Jehovah here. That is Seth Jehovah or Jehovah speaks. No, the Lord Jehovah is in command and all that. I'll point that out as we go along. That occurs some 54 times, I recall. We'll look at that. Well, all right. Now, the emphasis is going to be on the individual now. So, first of all, as we look at these visions that he has, we'll try to get the lesson from him, get the picture there, and then get the lesson drawn from it. And many of them, but one of the most outstanding is the one of chapter 1. Chapter 1 here, and this is a picture of the throne, the great movable throne of God. And the point of that movable chariot, or chariot throne rather, chariot throne is a good word, of this chariot throne is that God can be with the people in Babylon as well as he could be with the people in Judea. Because God is the God of, he is not limited to one particular location. And that's the point we want to get out of this first chapter. So that is a little bit of an introduction. Let's move now to the chapter itself. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captivity by the river Kibar, that the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity. Right? Now those numbers are a little bit confusing, but I think the point is that here the 30th year was the 30th year of Ezekiel, that is his 30th year. Now then, they had already been in Babylon for 5 years, because it was the fifth year of Jeconiah's captivity. So that would be then that here he begins to prophesy. He began in 597, then he began to prophesy at 592. So now that it was the beginning of his prophesy. Now, he continued to prophesy until something like 570 or 72. A little bit confusing which it is. So that would be a period of, let's just say around numbers, 20 years of Ezekiel's prophesying to the people. That would be from about 592 to about 570 or 72. We'll discuss that when we come to it, as to which we think it is. Probably 72 will give us at least 20 years there of his prophesying. And then that closes it. But what we'll see is the doom of the nation. The nation is doomed, and they're going to come to captivity. But the hope is that God will take them back, and ultimately there will be built the great spiritual temple. Now those last nine chapters, chapters 40 through 48, those chapters, very difficult. Because he's describing this great temple here, not something physical. It was never built materially. It was a spiritual concept. And I'll point out when I come to it what I think the lesson is in that. We'll try to get that lesson. All right, so now then here then, by the river Kibar, that the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. Now then, what he sees here in this vision is Jehovah's glory. Now this particular picture here of the chariot throne of God occurs four times in the book. Here at the beginning and the later on toward after they when they come back. In the fifth day of the fifth year, King Jehoiakim's captivity. Now Jehoiakim is also Konah, King Konah or Jehoiakim, and or Jeconiah. All three names are given to him. The word of Jehovah came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest. Now notice he was of the priestly tribe. I mean he was a Levite. The priest, the son of Bezai, in the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kibar. And the hand of Jehovah was there upon him. Right? Now you'll notice here that the Chaldeans, the land of the Chaldeans there, said a moment ago, that's the nation, that's the province of Chaldea. And now Babylon is the capital of it. And sometimes you have a little trouble keeping that clear in your mind. All right? And so now then, Jehovah there, the hand of Jehovah there upon him. Now he's far from home. So the hand of Jehovah can be upon him in Babylon, as well as it could be upon Jeremiah in Judah. Now remember that these two men, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, are contemporaries. Jeremiah was old, a little before. But much of the time, they were contemporary. So you have Jeremiah in Babylon prophesying, along with two or three others at that particular time, Habakkuk and Nahum and Zephaniah. There were about four minor prophets, and Jeremiah prophesying at the same time in Judah. And so you have two prophets now in Babylon. You have Daniel, and you have Ezekiel. Now, it's interesting to note that Daniel never addresses the people. He is the counselor of the kings of Babylon during those 70 years, but he never goes to the people with his message. Ezekiel is the prophet to the people. So God has two prophets in this eastern country here, one at the court of the ruler, that's Daniel, and Ezekiel for 20 years is prophesying to the people, preparing them for the fall of Jerusalem and the coming of the captives there. Right? So God is concerned about his people. He's watching over them all the time to bring about, ultimately, in spite of the captivities, he's going to bring about the coming of the Messiah. He's going to come, the new David. Now you remember that Hosea speaks of him as David, and Jeremiah speaks of him as David, and so does Ezekiel. So this David that these talk about is the son of David, that is the Christ. All right, now here's what he sees. And I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness round about it, and out of the midst thereof, as it were, glowing metal, out of the midst of the fire. Now try to get the picture. Now you're looking to the north, and here you see the storm coming. Here's these clouds and the wind, and they're enfolding themselves. Here's fire in it there. A very graphic picture, a very vivid thing that impressed itself upon him that time, and impressed us as we study it as something unusual there. And out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. That is, out of the midst of this cloud and storm was coming up, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one of them had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet were like excuse me, I'm trying to get going here for us. And were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished brass. Now, there's quite a similarity between this and the Messiah described in Revelation, the first chapter. There's several likenesses there, but we're not going to them now. And the sole of their feet were like and sparkled like burnished brass, and they had the hands of a man under their wings, and on their four sides, and they four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went everyone straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they had the face of a man, and they four had the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side. They four had also the face of an eagle. Now their faces and their wings were separate above. Two wings of every one were joined one to another.
made to cover their body. Now let's poll that for a moment. All right, now try to get the thing. Now, what do these four represent? Well, there's a division of opinion to what the four faces represent. Some think they represent the four realms of nature. Here is the realm of man, and then here is the wild beast, the lion. Here are the domesticated animals, the ox. And here's the eagle, that free bird that flies through the air and pounces on its prey. That may be correct. Others think that they represent, the man represents intelligence, the lion represents strength, the ox represents service, and the eagle represents speed in carrying out a thing. And that I think, is what it would be, I hold, or I don't know. Now, the difference between these four and those of Revelation 4 is in Revelation 4, the four living creatures, one has the face of a man, one has the face of an ox, one has the face of an eagle, the other has the face of a lion. So they have only one face in Revelation. Here they have the four. Now, it's possible that they represent the four realms of nature. It's possible that these four realms represent what I've said here as intelligence and strength and service and speed in carrying out a mission there. But at any rate, there is, it's a vision. No such thing ever existed that we know of. All right? Now, the feet being like burnished brass, if they can stand, they can tread down that the enemy, wherever it may be, or tread down what they're sent to tread down. It's simply a picture. The whole thing is a picture here that symbolizes what we're going to suggest in just a moment. Now, let me move on from that. And they went everyone straight forward, whether the Spirit was to go, they went. They turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. The appearance of torches. The fire went up and down among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned at the appearance of a flash of lightning. All right, now that indicates then the speed with which God could execute a judgment or carry out his will. Now these serve Jehovah, and they go yonder or yonder or wherever needs in a flash. So in a flash, God can be there to carry out his purpose or his will. So what the prophet sees in this vision is a vision that God's revealing to him of the fact that God will be in their midst, and God can carry out his purpose. And here he can use all the realms of nature, force, intelligence, and the service of it and all that, the speed with which it's carried out. Or he himself is directed by these four things, that is intelligence and strength and service and speed. So these are the four things symbolized. But now just how you apply them is a question, don't you see? A little bit questionable there. All right, now he moves on. Now here's where we sometimes get confused. Now, as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth beside the living creatures, for each of the four faces thereof. The appearance of the wheels and their work were like unto a beryl, that's green or bluish green, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was as it were a wheel within a wheel. And that's what I used to get to that. And I got confused, and when I began studying the Bible 60 years ago, I get to about that and quit. A long time before I really grapple with Ezekiel. But I think here's the idea. Now, here is a wheel, and here's a wheel within a wheel. That means it can go this way, or it can go this way, it can go this way, or this way, without turning. Now, Brother Clay and I were talking about this one time, that's impossible mechanically, so far as we know now. And it may be that after a while, because you've got to have an axle cross there. And of course, they didn't know anything about a lot of the things we have today, like an air thing that can make it come up or yonder and all that. But at any rate, when you think of it as a chariot, well, you've got to have an axle between the wheels. In a vision, you don't have to have that. So here then, in this great chariot throne that you see, go this way or that way or yonder way or this way, without turning. Now, here's why I think that is correct, not the correct interpretation. Now, notice here, when they went in their four directions. They turned not when they went. As for their rims, they were high and dreadful, and they four had their rims full of eyes rounded out. In other words, here the all-seeing eye of God now in his chariot sees everything, but it can go yonder, or this way or that way, without turning. Now I don't know that James had that in mind, but when James said in James 1 and 18, that every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation, neither shadow
It is cast by turning. God doesn't turn. So here it goes yonder, it goes yonder, this way or that way, wherever he needs to be there. God doesn't turn, he doesn't change. Malachi 3:6, I, Jehovah, change not, says Jehovah. Right? God doesn't change, God doesn't turn this way and yonder way, some other way. He has the principle by which always he acts. But now then, God can be anywhere, at any time. He represents that as a flash of lightning, right? And the speed of it. But this is why I understand the wheels this way, a wheel within a wheel, go in a direction and never turn there. Which, as I say, is impossible in a machine that demands an axle across it, but it's not impossible in a vision. So that's distinguished between a vision and a reality. This revision. Now, what's the vision revealing here? It's revealing God's throne chariot throne here, where God can be anywhere at any time. He can be with his people in Babylon just as well as he can be with his people in Jerusalem. See? And this is the thing that, of course, the Jews had the idea that God was only the God of the Jews and could be with only with his people in Jerusalem where the temple was. But now the temple is going to be destroyed. Now when the temple is going to be destroyed, then what about it? God can be anywhere just the way. He isn't confined to that temple. He isn't confined to a temple. All right? Now if you have a question, I want you to ask it in a moment. We're going to stop in just a moment. Full of eyes round about, seeing everything. God knows and sees everything. So God knows all, he sees all. So there's nothing hid from him there, and he can be everywhere at one time. All at one time, he's spirit. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. When the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Whithersoever the spirit was to go, they went. Whither was the spirit, they went. Whither was the spirit to go? And the wheels were lifted up, and the wheels were lifted up beside them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheel. So you see, it's the spirit of the living creature was in the wheel, it stood beside. So here, the spirit of the living creature directs this wheel whithersoever the chariot is to go. And it goes wherever God would be. And furthermore, when those went, these went, and when these stood, those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up beside them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. In other words, the whole thing is one, motivated and governed and directed by one spirit. The chariot and the intelligence, the knowledge and the action, whatever was done, it's all governed by the one spirit of God. So the point is that God is going to be in control in the whole thing. Now, he moves over and over the head of the living creatures. That was the likeness of a firmament, like a terrible crystal to look upon, stretched forth over their heads of probably the great crystal that I don't know, unless that's a great ice cap somewhere with which they were familiar. Well, that would be up on Mount Hermon or whatever it might have been. But anyway, here now, above this chariot is the firmament here, like the heavens here. And over their heads above, and under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Everyone had two which covered on the side, and everyone had two which covered on that side, their bodies. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a noise of two. Now, that's an expression occurs mostly in Job or in the early patriarch. God the Almighty, a noise, a tumult like the noise of a host. When they stood, they let down their wings, and there was a voice above the firmament that was over their heads. When they stood, they let down their wings. All right, now here's quiet when God speaks. Now there's a voice above. Now when God speaks, they are quiet. Now then they carry out whatever that purpose of God is. So your picture here, a little difficult to grasp, but try to get the idea that here now is in a vision. There is a throne, a chariot throne, in which these servants of God are active. These four living creatures here. And here's fire up and down, the fire of judgment, if that's what's necessary, or of God's presence. Now, as he moves on from that, and above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne as the appearance of a sapphire stone, that's a blue stone,
and upon the likeness of the throne was a likeness of the appearance of a man upon it above. Now, in Revelation, God is never likened unto a man there. But I think Ezekiel is, so they can understand what he told about. There's a likeness of a man there, symbolic of God, upon his throne. So the picture there is as I've been describing it. And I saw as it were glowing metal, as the appearance of fire within it round about, from the appearance of his loins and upward, and from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire. Well, that word appearance so often, not something little, but there is the appearance of it here in this, and that was the brightness round about him, as the appearance of the bull that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so the appearance of the brightness round about. Now this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Jehovah. Now that is your explanation of what this was, the whole thing there. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. I heard a voice of one that spake. All right. Now that light. So what is this great picture of? It's a picture of the glory of Jehovah, who can be anywhere at any time. And that God in his glory can be a consuming fire, as we learned in Hebrews, how God is a consuming fire. Or he can be there as a fire protection to them, or as one who watches after them. In other words, he is not limited to any particular place. So this appearance of the glory of Jehovah occurs four times in the book. And we'll just take what Ezekiel said there and try to see the picture as best we can. As here is a chariot, and here's Jehovah upon the chariot, and here's all the glory that surrounds him there in every way. And what he's seeing here is a picture of the appearance of the glory of Jehovah. Now, if I can accept that. I may not be able to understand all the aspects of it. I can try to envision, I can try to visualize it. I try to see that. Here's a coming storm. Here the storm is coming here in the fire and pour yourself. And now that out of this storm appears now the glory of Jehovah. So the storm, I think, symbolizes the storm of God's wrath and judgment against Judah. That storm is on its way. But out of that storm, in the storm, is the glory of Jehovah carrying out his purpose, his ultimate purpose. And so, if here, now, these who have been brought over into captivity, Ezekiel's purpose now is to impress them with the greatness and the goodness of God and the glory of God. Also to impress them with the fact that Jerusalem will be destroyed. The people come into captivity. So here now is the appearance of the glory of Jehovah. Now when we come to chapters 8 through 11, we see this same picture here. Here the glory of Jehovah appears over the temple. Then it raises up and over the court, then departs and goes in the 11th chapter, goes over to the east, to the Mount of Olives there. And that means that God's glory departed from Jerusalem. But that glory can be with them in Babylon, as well as it was there. It's going to depart from Jerusalem. It's going to leave there. And so when it does, then the temple will be destroyed, the whole thing will be destroyed, and they'll be brought into captivity there. Now this is his message. Now, I think that it's difficult. But if there's any question that you have on what I've said, which I didn't make myself clear, I'll be glad to go back over it and help you as best I can. Any question to anybody? So what I'm suggesting to you is this. As you read that, try to see a picture here of this vision in all this majesty, all this glory, and in all this terror. To me, it would be a terrifying vision to see that. So I'd see it. Well, our God is a consuming fire. But he's also the God of love and of peace. He wants to have peace and all that. But he insists on righteousness. Now, as I preached last Sunday morning and night on God, the picture of God, as the Bible reveals him, is always consistent. Always, he's absolute in his righteousness and holiness. But he's also terrible in his judgment and his wrath. But you see that all the way from the flood back in the days of Noah, over here to the end in Revelation, when you see the great white throne there and the heaven and the earth vanish away before it there, you see the same picture of God all the way through. The Old Testament may emphasize the sternness of God. The New Testament may emphasize the love and the mercy and the long-suffering of God. But when you put them together, the picture is always the same. There is loving kindness back in the Old Testament, and there's wrath over the New Testament. but an emphasis of one in the old, an emphasis of the other in the new. What we're looking for in all of our study is to come to know God. This to me has become one of the most important things that I can preach on or insist upon or help people to do, is to come to know Jehovah. Come to know the Lord and all of His attributes and character. Know Him as a Father. Know Jesus Christ as a friend. Know them as one who loves you and wants to save you. But also come to know God in Christ as being capable of wrath and indignation and those things, and of judgment against wicked people. So, we had this week. A couple of friends came by, and before I spent the night with him, we talked all afternoon and all the next morning. But he and I are there, we see this exactly alike. One of the most lacking things among our people today is a realization of God. Heard about Him? Know about Him. But the realization of Him as what He actually is and who He is, I don't think we really grasp it. Both sides of the coin. The goodness of God and the wrath of God. The mercy of God and the judgment of God. You see, we've got to understand both of these. And a second thing that I think we're lacking in today in the church, I'm talking about the church generally now, where I've been holding meetings, where I know the people, is a lack of realization of the importance of an individual coming to know the Word of God, and that God instructs and directs us and reveals us only through His Word. This friend of mine, I haven't come into contact much, he has. He said he's finding people over the country that are, he's a preacher, saying, well, the Lord told me to do this, or the Lord instructed me, I was about to do it, and God told me to do something else here. In other words, they're looking to God to speak to them directly. I had a letter yesterday from my grandson up in the college up in Oklahoma there, which he brought out that the people that he, young people he's talking to now, well, you don't have to know this or that or something else. The mercy of God is going to cover everything. It's going to cover a lot, but it's not going to cover my ignorance or my indifference. And so instead of looking to see what God says, was his point, why they're expecting God to take care of it apart from that. Well, this is becoming, I think, one of the things we've got to face today in our preaching and teaching and our own lives, is the necessity of a comprehension and knowledge of God. When we stand before Him in judgment, it's going to be too late then. Too late then to find out who He is and what He is. Too late then to find out what He said and what He didn't say. Now is the acceptable time. Today is the day of salvation. So I just can't overemphasize this fact in my own life, and help to emphasize in your life the idea this is life eternal, that they should know Thee, the only true God, and Him whom Thou didst send, even Jesus Christ. And I have no substitute for the Word of God. And I don't make the Word of God substitute the Word of God for the Spirit of God, and the Spirit for the Word. The Spirit of God revealed the Word unto it. But it's the Word of God that directs our path. Thy Word is a light unto my path, a lamp unto my path, and a light unto my feet. I've laid up Thy Word in my heart that I might not sin against Thee. The entrance of Thy Word giveth light, and it giveth understanding. So, let's emphasize those things. Well, my time is up. We got through the first chapter there. Now, as you go back over that, and I hope you will, try to get the vision of what He sees there, and try to get the significance of it. God can be here, yonder, anywhere, but God doesn't change. He is God without turning. He's always the same. So His love one time, His love another time, His hate one time, what He hates one time, He still hates. He doesn't change. We'll leave that, and the next time we'll take about a couple of chapters. We're not going to try to take every bit of this and every little detail of it. We'll try to get the whole complete picture as we go through of God's concern for His people. His doom of the wicked, but the ultimate salvation of the righteous. He's concerned with the individual. Or the class is excused.